Let's turn in our Bibles to our text. Our text is Genesis 29. I jump into this part of the life of Jacob with a little bit of excitement and a little bit of trepidation. There are some odd things that go on in Jacob's life that we have to wrestle through. But what do these things mean? This is a patriarch whose name is significant, not just in Genesis, but throughout the scriptures. This is the origin of the 12 tribes of Israel, which have a place in the New Testament as a foundation for the church. So we have to wrestle a little bit with how we reconcile the kinds of things that happen in Jacob's life with the fact that God is working through these circumstances to bring about his purposes and salvation. So we're going to wrestle through that a little bit today. We'll probably wrestle through it even more next week as we see in chapter 30, 11 children being born in a matter of 7 to 10 years with Jacob and 4 different women. But that's also connected to our story today. Genesis 29, verses 1 through 30. I might encourage you to just notice a couple connections, and we'll talk more about them after I read. But there are two stories I think that should be in the back of our minds as we read this. First of all, there's another story in Genesis where someone goes to a well to find a wife, right? Anybody remember what that story is? You can shout it out. Rebecca, right? We're going to see some parallels and some contrasts in this story with that. So we're going to talk some about that. But also, I think we should have in the back of our minds what Rebecca and Jacob do to Isaac, because it happens to him. And the parallels are pretty striking. And so we're going to wrestle through what that means and why those stories are being repeated and what it teaches us about salvation. Well, let's listen carefully. Genesis 29, I'll be reading verses 1 through 30, and let's remember that this is God's word. Then Jacob went on his journey and came to the land of the people of the east. As he looked, he saw a well in the field, and behold, 3 flocks of sheep lying beside it, for out of that well the flocks were watered. The stone on the well's mouth was large, and when all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep, and put the stone back in its place over the mouth of the well. Jacob said to them, "My brothers, where do you come from?" They said, "We are from Haran." He said to them, "Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?" They said, "We know him." He said to them, "Is it well with him?" They said, "It is well, and see, Rachel, his daughter, is coming with the sheep." He said, "Behold, it is still high day. It is not time for the livestock to be gathered together. Water the sheep and go, pasture them." But they said, "We cannot until all the flocks are gathered together and the stone is rolled from the mouth of the well. Then we water the sheep." While he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. Now, as soon as Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob came near and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and wept aloud. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's kinsman and that he was Rebekah's son. And she ran and told her father. As soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, his sister's son, he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his house. Jacob told Laban all these things, and Laban said to him, "Surely you are my bone and my flesh." And he stayed with him a month. Then Laban said to Jacob, "Because you are my kinsman, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what shall your wages be?" Now Laban had 2 daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful in form and appearance. Jacob loved Rachel, and he said, "I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel." Laban said, "It is better that I give her to you than that I should give her to any other man. Stay with me." So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him but a few days because of the love he had for her. Then Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife, that I may go into her, for my time is completed." So Laban gathered together all the people of the place and he made a feast. But in the evening he took his daughter Leah and brought her to Jacob, and he went into her. Laban gave his female servant Zilpah to his daughter Leah to be her servant. And in the morning, behold, it was Leah. And Jacob said to Laban, "What is this you have done to me? Did I not serve with you for Rachel? Why then have you deceived me?" Laban said, "It is not so done in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Complete the week of this one, and we will give you the other also in return for serving me another 7 years." Jacob did so and completed her week. Then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to be his wife. Laban gave his female servant Bilhah to his daughter Rachel to be her servant. So Jacob went in to Rachel also, and he loved Rachel more than Leah, and served Laban for another 7 years. So what is this story about? And maybe I should start by saying what the story is not about, or at least not primarily about. A lot of times when we read the story, the thing that comes to our mind, and frankly the thing that comes to most commentators' minds, is that the story teaches us that Jacob reaps what he sows, and therefore, if you're going to do something like Jacob, you can expect to be punished for it. Now, that might be true. In fact, it is true. And we're going to talk about that some in this story. Jacob certainly reaps what he sows. But that's not the point. It's not the main point of this story. There's a theme developing in the story of Jacob's life. We saw that in Abraham's life as well. The theme of Abraham's life was faith. What does it mean to live in the time between the promise and the reality? And how do you pilgrim through life knowing that the promise, the reality of the promise is way in front of you and that you're not going to get there? That was kind of the theme of Abraham's life. Jacob's life is a little bit different. We learn in his life about the sovereign grace of God. Do you ever read the story of Jacob and think, "God, couldn't you find someone better than Jacob?" I mean, I think that sometimes. Is this really the best face to put on the covenant? Jacob, deceiver, foolish, striving in his own strength to do the things that God's promised to do. What we learn in the life of Jacob and what he learns through these trials that he faces, and most of the trials, by the way, are of his own making. But through these trials, he learns this, that the Lord accomplishes his purposes for his people, and he does that even through the wickedness and the foolishness of men and women. This is how one theologian describes it. Ian Duguid has a little book about the life of Isaac and Jacob, and he says it in this way: God delights in writing straight with a crooked pencil. I mean, how does that do for describing Jacob? Writing straight with a crooked pencil. And it doesn't just describe Jacob. It's also going to describe his interactions with Laban. God writes out his covenant and works it out even through wicked, sinful men and even through their wicked actions. Now, the story begins at a well. That's significant throughout the scriptures. It starts when Abraham sends his servant to find Isaac's wife, Rebekah. It takes us all the way to the woman at the well in John 4. There are significant things that happen with these encounters at the well. But I think in particular, as we're reading the story, we need to have in mind Genesis 24. Just as Abraham sent his servant to Haran to find a wife for his son among his own family, so Isaac and Rebekah send Jacob to the same city, Haran, to find a wife from their family. In fact, this is very likely the same well. This is a dry area. You don't have three or four wells in a small town like Haran. This is probably the exact same well where Isaac's wife, Rebekah, was found for him. Incidentally, by the way, we find a similar story with Moses, right? Where does he find his wife? At a well in the middle of the desert in Midian, a place where shepherds would go to feed their flocks. And his wife ends up being a shepherdess with her parents' flocks. And Moses helps her to water her sheep. And I think as Moses is telling the story, he has us in mind, us looking back to Jacob as well. So the main story in our head, at least at the beginning, is the story of Abraham's servant finding Rebekah and how that relates to what happens with Jacob. In fact, Jacob probably has the same story in his mind. Most of you that are married and have kids, you probably told your kids sometimes about how you met your spouse and, you know, how wonderful it was. And you make it sound even better than it was originally, right? We tell our kids those stories. Rebecca is almost certainly in her time in the tent with Jacob, told him about the time this servant came to find her and her joy and her fears and her expectations. He's heard this before. And so even in his mind, he probably has the same story. Of course, there are some very real differences between Jacob and Abraham's servant, not the least of which is that Jacob comes by himself. He doesn't have camels and servants helping him on the journey. He's alone. And he doesn't come with a big dowry to give to Laban. You remember that one of the reasons that Laban is so excited to send off Rebekah is because the servant comes with bracelets and gold and great riches. And Laban is more than happy to take those things away from the servant and willing to send Rebekah in return. Jacob doesn't have those things. And that plays into our story in an important way in a little bit. But there are certain similarities as well. And the primary similarity is that we see the Lord blessing Jacob's search. I think sometimes we don't know how to read the Old Testament. We read that all these things happen. And so we read in verse 2 that Jacob came to this place and he saw a well. We read in verse 4 that he just so happens to meet men from Haran, which is where Rebekah and Isaac have sent him. He asked them about Laban and they know Laban. And not only do they know Laban, but they say, oh, there's his daughter coming to the well right now with the flock. And I think we read it and think, wow, isn't that a great coincidence? No, we're supposed to see the hand of God. And in some ways, in the Old Testament, the writers will do that on purpose. All these things seem like coincidence. And the only explanation is not coincidence, but the sovereign hand of God, who directs Jacob to that very well, to those very shepherds, and it brings him to that well at the very time that Rachel comes to water her sheep. These things don't just happen. God directs. God gives success. But Jacob is very different than Abraham's servant. Think about it. Did you think about that as you're reading it? How different Jacob approaches the well as opposed to Abraham's servant? Remember, Abraham's servant is a very pious, God-fearing man. So he approaches in prayer. He asks God for success because he knows that he will only have success if God directs everything that happens. He seeks the face of God. He asks him for guidance. And even as he waits for someone to come, he prays for God to make it clear who is the right woman for Isaac and to show him signs so that it be clear to him. And when God gives him success, what does the servant do?
Bows down
and worship. He thanks God. And when he goes and talks to Laban, how does the servant describe everything to Laban? He keeps telling him, the Lord gave me success. The Lord granted me success. Not once in this story does Jacob have the name of the Lord on his lips. Not once does he ask for the Lord to grant success. Not once does he pray for guidance. In fact, it seems pretty evident by the way that Rachel is described later in verses 17 and 18 as being beautiful in form and appearance, that the reason that Jacob is drawn to Rachel isn't because God's made it clear that that's the woman for him. It's because she's gorgeous and he wants to have that woman. He doesn't sound anything like Abraham's servant. In fact, I think that's part of the idea of the story that we're supposed to get. Remember, Jacob is still striving against God. He's still needing to learn dependence on God. And I think what happens in this story is that Jacob identifies this particular woman as his choice, not because God directed him to her, but because she's beautiful. At least that's what he thinks. So he chooses her because she's beautiful, and he sets out to earn her. Not to receive her by the grace and guidance of God, but to receive her by, again, his scheming and his plotting so that he can earn this woman. No sense of God's grace, no sense of God's sovereign control of the situation. And we see right away, even in the way that he talks to the shepherds, we see this schemer, Jacob, springing into action. So he asked them, beginning in verse 4, where do you come from? We're from Haran. He asks them if they know Laban, and they say, we know him. And he asks them, is it well with him? And they said, it's well. And look, Rachel, his daughter, is coming with the sheep. And what does Jacob do? He tries to get rid of them. They're in his way now. He wants to talk to this woman. Forget these shepherds. And so he basically says, don't you have something better to do? Shouldn't your sheep be out in the pasture? Quick, let's give them some water so that you can leave. And they don't want to go because they're waiting for the other shepherds to come and to be able to lift this heavy stone together so that they can feed their sheep and go into the field. So Jacob's already has this plan. How is he going to gain this woman's attention? And how is he going to gain her affections? Now, what's interesting, by the way, what happens in verse 9 and 10 is we begin to see the strength of Jacob. Now, I hadn't thought about this so much except for in the wrestling story. But usually when we think of Jacob, he's the one that's in the tent with his mother. Esau's the one who's the hunter and the gatherer. And so I think we usually think of Jacob as a little bit effeminate. Well, think about how this story describes the well. This stone is really large, and it's very clear that it takes more than one man to lift it. In fact, the shepherds all wait to come together so that they can lift it together because it's such difficult labor. In fact, there's something about how the wells are done there. The stone's there for a purpose. First of all, to keep the water clean. But secondly, to keep someone from stealing the water. You can't just walk up to this well by yourself and lift the stone and take the water. You come as a group. And so there's this security issue behind it. But what does Jacob do? He walks up by himself and picks up this huge stone and moves it so that he can get water for Rachel. And you get a sense of his strength and of his determination that he's going to do this in his own strength and in his own timing and according to his will and his desires. And so he moves the stone and he waters the sheep of Rachel. And then, as we're told in the rest of that section, verses 11 and 12, he kisses Rachel. He weeps in front of her and he tells her who he is, that he's a relative who's come to meet Laban. Now, before we go on, I want to ask if there are any questions. Yeah.
What's the purpose of the weeping?
The weeping? I don't know if we know for sure, but I'm just trying to imagine this man by himself who's traveling over 400 miles, probably by foot. He's probably just really glad that he's there. And that he's found the family that he's looking for. So I think that's what's going on.
So will this be the same Laban as Abraham's Laban, you think?
Yep.
I mean, it's only, what, 45 years?
40 or 45 years later, maybe a little bit more. But if you remember, Laban wasn't really the head of the house. Bethel is the head of the house. But Laban's the one that the servant speaks to, at least in the story. And that's either because Bethel is so old that Laban's kind of in charge now, or it might even be kind of a foreshadowing that both times when a man comes to a well to look for a wife, Laban's the one that you deal with. Because you get a sense in 24, Moses is starting to show us the character of the man who is Laban. And then he reveals it even more in chapter 29. So it is the same man. Not exactly sure why he's in charge in both situations. Mike, did you have a hand up?
Yes. Any question on Laban's material wealth by the fact that the tribes that work with the shepherds?
Oh, I don't think he's particularly wealthy, probably. And I wonder, you know, that his daughters are working as shepherds might mean that just he doesn't have any sons. I mean, that's kind of what you find with Moses and Zipporah, that this man has a lot of daughters, and so they shepherd. So it might have to do with wealth. That might have to do with not having sons. Not sure. It's one of the reasons that he's really happy to keep her for 7 years. He gets double or triple the labor once he adds Jacob to Rachel. Yeah, anything else? All right, let's keep moving. So Rachel goes to tell her father about Jacob. You might have noticed there was a little bit of I don't know how to describe it. It's a little bit of a strange rhythm of the language in verse 10 where it keeps saying his mother's brother. I think he's just emphasizing that Jacob's found the right person and that in that sense he's obeying his parents' wishes. He's going to find the right family and the right woman. And then in verse 13, we have it again. As soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, his sister's son. So we're just reminding you, he's found the right family, his sister's son. And Laban runs to meet him and embraces him and kisses him and brings him to his house. Now remember, this is the same way that Laban greeted Abraham's servant. Now, it's very clear in chapter 24 that the reason that Laban is so excited to greet the servant is because it's really clear that he has a lot of stuff, which means that Abraham's rich. Now, why he comes as quickly now, I don't know if he's remembering how rich Abraham was and assumes that if this is Isaac and Rebekah's son, he must be rich as well. But it's pretty clear that he doesn't have the same kind of wealth, at least traveling with him. But he's excited to greet him and welcomes him into his home. And it says at the end of verse 13 that Jacob told Laban all these things. Now, that's a classic Hebrew kind of thing to do. It really doesn't tell us anything. We're not sure what he tells Laban. Does he tell him the whole story? I tricked my dad, cheated my brother out of the birthright. I doubt that he does, although, I mean, if he told him, it'd be interesting that Laban says right after that, surely you are my bone and my flesh, because, I mean, if Jacob's a great deceiver, Laban is probably even more so. I mean, Jacob meets his match with this man. But he tells him enough, at least, for Laban to know something about why Jacob is there. So Jacob stays a month. And after he stays a month, Laban comes to him with a proposition in verse 15. He says, because you are my kinsman, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me what shall your wages be? Now, I always used to read this and think that Laban was a pretty reasonable person. You know, what kindness he's showing to Jacob that he wants to pay him for his work. I don't think, the more that I've thought about this, that that's what we should get. I think Laban is looking for an angle. First of all, this is his nephew. Should Jacob be willing to serve him for nothing? Well, kind of. They're family. He should be willing to serve him. And he wouldn't really be serving him for nothing, because Laban should be more than willing to simply feed him and give him a place to live. They shouldn't need a contract. They're family. So I think there's something here where Laban's saying, hey, here's an angle. What can I get out of this man? And there's a sense in which he's already seen from Jacob, this man who lifts a huge stone from a well that's meant for several men to lift, and he's lifted it by himself. He's probably a pretty good worker, and he can get a lot of labor out of him. And so I think Laban's trying to work an angle, hatch a plan, figure out how he can use this relationship with his nephew to his own advantage. But he's also run into someone like Jacob who has a plan as well. And so Jacob hears this request, what can I pay you for your wages? And he has a great idea of how he can be paid for his labor. We have a little insertion here in verses 16 through 18 to describe for us the two daughters of Laban. It's a little bit unclear what's meant here. It says the name of the older was Leah and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were weak. The Hebrew's really unclear as to what it means. I don't think that she has bad eyesight. I don't think the way we've usually understood it is that her eyes are dim. I don't think that's it. I think generally what you're supposed to get from the comparison is Leah might be all right to look at, but Rachel is a knockout. I mean, I think that's what he's trying to get at. Rachel is really beautiful, and Leah pales in comparison. She's a dim reflection of her sister. And Jacob sees it right away. Now think about this for a minute, though. Think again about how different Jacob is from Abraham's servant. What kind of woman was Abraham's servant looking for? He was looking for someone who was hospitable, kind to strangers, hardworking, loving, compassionate, reflected the love of God that he's shown to his children. And Jacob's simply looking for someone who's beautiful. Now, I have some sons. There's some instruction for my sons here. There's some instruction for sons and daughters in this room, isn't there? What's the first thing you should be looking for? Not necessarily for someone who's gorgeous. You should be looking for someone who's godly. And I think there's some instruction here for Jacob as well, as we can learn from his life that Rachel was maybe not the kind of woman that is the best encouragement to a godly man. But this is the one that Jacob loves. It's pretty clear. He loves Rachel and not Leah. And so he has a plan for Laban. He says in verse 18, I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel. And Laban likes this idea. Think about it. 7 years of essentially free labor from Rachel and from Jacob. That's a good price for his daughter. That's weird for us to think about, by the way, a price for your daughter. But that's the culture. I mean, We heard Bob Wright last week talk about Uganda and how many cows that you give for a woman. And if she's a really valuable woman who's strong and will work hard, I forget, something like 80 cows. She's worth 80 cows. But if she's kind of weak and small and not as productive, she might be worth 40 or 50 cows. I mean, that's the kind of culture that we're seeing here. What's a price that your daughter's worth? And Jacob offers a price that's probably far beyond the price that anyone would expect to get for their daughter. But Jacob offers it because he really wants Rachel, and he'll pay whatever price he needs to get her. So Laban says, basically, sounds great. It's better that I should give her to you than any other man. So stay with me, work those 7 years. And it says that Jacob served 7 years for Rachel. And this is one of those great sentences in the Bible. And they seemed to him but a few days because of the love he had for her. That's the first 7 years, not the second seven. But these ones went fast because he was excited that he could marry Rachel. Now, before we move forward, are there any questions about that section? All right. So here's the deal that's in front of us. Jacob works 7 years. He gets Rachel. Well, you get a sense already in verse 21 of the kind of man that Laban is. Because it's pretty clear that the 7 years are done and that Jacob's done a good job. And Laban hasn't even talked to him about when the wedding is going to happen. And it seems pretty clear that Jacob's agitated. I worked hard for 7 years. It's time for my wife. And so he comes to Laban and says, give me my wife that I may go into her, for my time is completed. Now, this is an imperative, a command. Understand that. So this is basically a son to his soon-to-be father saying, I've done the work. Give me my wife. But notice as well what he doesn't say. He doesn't say, give me Rachel. Now, I don't know if that's really what he said or if the author is giving us a sense of what's about to happen. But in essence, Laban does exactly what Jacob asked him to. Give me my wife. Okay, I'll give you a wife. It's just not going to be Rachel. So Laban gathers together all the people of the place and he makes a feast. Verse 22. Now, this maybe isn't as controversial for Presbyterians as it would be for fundamentalists, but the word feast, it's not just a feast. It's a drinking festival. That's the word here. It's a very specific word. He gives them lots of alcohol. And it seems as if part of the reason that Jacob doesn't quite figure out what's going on is because he's had a lot to drink. He doesn't have the full use of his faculties at his disposal when he goes to bed that night. So first of all, he fills him with alcohol. And then he waits until the evening to bring Leah. And he brought her to Jacob and he went into her. And he brings her, probably covered in a veil. Remember that when Rebecca meets Isaac and she gets off the camel, what is the first thing she does? She pulls the veil over her face so that he can't look at her. And so Leah's coming when Jacob is a little bit incapacitated in the darkness of the night with a veil over her head. Everything that he can do to trick him. And I love verse 25. So after these things happen and he spends the night with Leah, it says, verse 25, and in the morning, behold, it was Leah. And the word behold really can also be translated look. I mean, that's essentially the picture you should have. Jacob wakes up and he sits up and he turns and it's not Rachel. He can see clearly and it's the wrong woman. And so essentially he runs to Jacob and he says, what have you done to me? Did I not serve with you for Rachel? Why then have you deceived me? Now, before we move to what Laban does, think about what's happened to Jacob and how closely it reflects what Jacob did to his father. Did you think about that as you were reading it? But what is the first thing that that Rebekah sends Jacob to do? He comes to his father with food and drink. And Laban comes to Jacob with food and drink until he's satisfied, to get on his good side, essentially. Jacob arrives under the cover of Esau's clothing with animal skins to cover him so that you can't tell who he really is. And Leah comes covered in a veil. Jacob comes to Isaac under the cover of the darkness of his father's blindness. Leah comes to Jacob in the cover of night and the darkness of the evening. And then even in the way that Jacob responds, he's angry, he's frustrated. And look at what he says to Laban again, the very last question of verse 25. Why then have you deceived me? Now, what does the name Jacob mean? I mean, essentially what he's saying is, why have you Jacobed me? And that's the exact same word that Esau uses for his brother. When Isaac tells him, I've already given the blessing to your brother, Esau says, he's deceived me again. And now Jacob's been deceived. Now, I want us to understand that while I don't think this is the main point, it is very true that our sins are revisited upon us. And there's a justice in what happens here. Not that what Laban does is right, but Jacob, in essence, deserves what he gets. He's the great deceiver, and now he's been deceived by someone who's maybe even a little bit more skilled in deception than even Jacob. But then notice Laban as well, and the character of this man, beginning in verse 26. You might expect some remorse, maybe an apology. I'm sorry that I did this. That's not at all what you get from Laban. Laban says in verse 26, it is not so done in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Now, first of all, think about this. That probably would have been a good thing to tell Jacob 7 years ago. He waits till now. Maybe he thought that certainly Leah would get married in the next 7 years, and so then it would be okay for Rachel to get married. But really, I mean, he could have told him this 7 years ago. But secondly, think about the irony of this. I mean, there's a sense in which he's saying, maybe in your country the younger supplants the older, but not where we live. And I think it tells us something about the sovereignty of God. We see mostly in the Old Testament the way that God works is he chooses the younger before the older, but not always. Sometimes he chooses the older before the younger. And why? Because I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, of compassion on whom I have compassion. Because he's in charge. He's the sovereign God. He chooses. And think about it. I think we usually think of Rachel as the matriarch of the covenant. But it's really Leah, isn't it? Her third son is Levi, the head of the priests. Her fourth son is Judah, the one through whom the promise will pass. The line of the kings and the line of Jesus. And so this man who is the younger, who gets the promise over the older, marries the woman who is the older and gets the promise over the younger. And God does it. And he's glorified by it. Well, Laban, rather than being remorseful, offers a second deal. He says, complete the week of this one. In other words, a wedding ceremony is a week-long ceremony. Spend this week celebrating the fact that you married the wrong woman, essentially. And when that week is over, you can have a second wedding. And I'll give you Rachel. And then you can work for 7 more years because I've given you my second daughter as well. Now think about how twisted this is. He's already deceived and cheated and lied, and now he tells him to marry a second woman, which clearly violates the commands of God. Some people, by the way, say, oh, God doesn't command until later in Leviticus and Deuteronomy that you should only be married to one woman, and so it's okay for the patriarchs. That's not true at all. Marriage is a creation mandate. You become one flesh with one woman. Genesis 2. He's clearly violating the plan and design of God. But think as well. Of the selfishness of Laban. Does he really think this is kind to his daughters? I mean, have you ever run into two girlfriends, not sisters, who have plans for the same man? It doesn't usually go real well, right? But imagine two sisters who not only are striving for the attention of the same man, but are actually married to the same man. Does he really think that this is a good thing for Leah or for Rachel or for Jacob? Clearly, we'll see in the next chapter, it's not. But Laban gets what he wants. 7 more years of the labor of Leah and Rachel and Jacob so that he can prosper. And he does prosper, by the way, because of the way that God blesses Jacob. Now, Jacob agrees to do this. He completes the week with Leah. And then Laban gives him his daughter Rachel to be his wife. And then in verse 30, we're told that Jacob went into Rachel also, and he loved Rachel more than Leah and served Laban for another 7 years. Now that phrase, he loved Rachel more than Leah, it can also be translated, he loved Rachel rather than Leah. And I think that's more accurate. No love for Leah, he only loves Rachel. But he's married to her and he's stuck with her. And that's essentially the reason for the hostility that Leah harbors in her heart, understandably, for Jacob and for Rachel. Now, what do we do with this story? I mean, it's an ugly, twisted story, isn't it? We don't know too many families that have circumstances that look like this, thankfully. This is ugly. But this is the line of the covenant. The seed of the woman, not the seed of the serpent. You might expect this from the descendants of Cain. These are the descendants of Adam and Seth and Noah and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. So what do we do with this? Well, there are a couple hints that we get in our story. There were two verses I skipped. You might have noticed that. Verse 24 and verse 29. They're odd interruptions into the story. So we read about this trick in verse 23 that Leah comes to Jacob and he went into her. And you'd expect the very next verse to talk about the next morning. But inserted in the middle is this little parenthetical sentence. Laban gave his female servant Zilpah to his daughter Leah to be her servant. Same thing in verse 28. We have this description of Laban giving his daughter Rachel to be his wife. And you'd expect the next verse to be verse 30. So Jacob went into Rachel and he loved Rachel more than Leah. But no, there's this parenthetical sentence inserted. Laban gave his female servant Bilhah to his daughter Rachel to be her servant. What do we do with that? I want you to think about the Israelites in Egypt or in the wilderness hearing this story for the first time. They know the story of the 12 tribes of Israel. And they probably know which mother bore which tribe. The names Rachel and Leah, certainly, but they probably know the names Zilpah and Bilhah, the four mothers of the 12 tribes of Israel. And if you're an Israelite, there's almost nothing more important than to know which tribe you belong to and where you come from and where you're going. And when they come into the promised land and they're still reading Genesis, they know their tribe because they go live with their tribe. This is where the tribe of Judah, this is the tribe of Benjamin, this is the tribe of Reuben. They know their history and they know their genealogy. That's, I think, why Moses inserts here these names. What is God doing in this circumstance? As ugly and sinful and deceptive and wicked as this story is, he's beginning to build his covenant people. And it's through these four women and Jacob that the 12 tribes of Israel will be produced. It's an ugly history, isn't it? Yes, David.
So what tribes are
next week. I have to come back next week. Yeah. Yeah, we'll talk about that more next week as we go through an almost uglier chapter. Chapter 30. Wives trading their husbands for mandrakes. I don't even know what a mandrake is yet, but we'll figure that out by next week. But I think that's more than anything else what we're supposed to take from the story. Not that by God working through these situations, he approves of what Laban does. He's not the author of sin. But he can redirect sin in such a way that he works out his good purposes and salvation. And if there's any other place to learn it, you learn it in the life of Jacob. Four wives. By the way, once we read chapter 30, none of you will ever want four wives. It's ugly. Painful. But for whatever reason, this is how God's determined to work out his plan of salvation. And this is the line through which ultimately Jesus Christ will come. We'll see that even more next week. This is the birth of the chosen sons of Jacob. It begins in chapter 29. There's this quote from John Flavel. He was a Puritan preacher. He said, "Some providences, like Hebrew letters, must be read backwards." You almost have to know the end to understand what's happening in chapter 29. Like the Israelites, you have to know who Bilhah and Zilpah are. So you begin to understand that no matter how ugly this is, God works through and he redirects these wicked, sinful actions of men and does it in such a way that in the end he's glorified. And in the end, he brings about his great salvation through this family.